From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The only problem is if we shoot on the Hill, it'll be an international crisis. We're too close to the border. Would save some time, though, wouldn't it?
The FBI arrests the head of a right-wing vigilante group in New Mexico days after the group filmed itself holding nearly 300 migrants at gunpoint near the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll speak with the New Mexico head of the ACLU. Then we look at a pair of campus immigration protests. In Baltimore, students at Johns Hopkins have entered their 20th day of a sit-in occupation protesting the university's plans for an armed police force on campus, as well as the school's contracts with ICE. Plus, we go to the University of Arizona, Tucson, where charges have been dropped against three students for protesting a Border Patrol presentation on campus. And we'll speak with Dee Watkins, author of We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America.
Any white liberal that's concerned about rising authoritarianism in Trump's America, I would say you're right. Right now, we're seeing something that we probably never thought we'll see in our lifetime. As a black person, I've always felt like that. When I see police officers, I already think like, yo, like, you know, is this cop a horrible person or is this cop just somebody who I'm going to, you know, pass by? And I had to consciously live with that like forever.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Sri Lanka's defense minister says Sunday's coordinated bombings at churches and hotels across the island nation were a response to last month's attacks on mosques by a white nationalist gunman who killed 50 Muslim worshippers in the New Zealand city of Christchurch. Sri Lankan officials say a little-known Muslim organization called National Tawhid Jamaat carried out the Easter Sunday bombings with another Sri Lankan group known as the JMI. Separately, the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the bombings, though it offered no evidence. The death toll from the bombings rose today to 321, with more than 500 injured, as Sri Lanka marks a national day of mourning. The Trump administration said Monday it'll fully enforce unilaterally imposed U.S. sanctions against Iran, ending a waiver program that allowed some nations to continue buying Iranian oil without suffering penalties from the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the tightening of sanctions Monday, saying the move will benefit Saudi Arabia and other U.S. allies in the Gulf.
The United States has been in constant discussion with allies and partners to help them transition away from Iranian crude to other alternatives. And we've been working with major oil-producing countries to ensure the market has sufficient volume to minimize the impact on pricing. Both the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have assured us they will ensure an appropriate supply for the markets.
Chinese authorities immediately pushed back against the move to ratchet up sanctions, saying it jeopardizes talks with the U.S. aimed at ending President Trump's trade war. China's Iran's single biggest customer of oil, consuming about half of the 1 million barrels Iran exports daily. Iran's economy has suffered heavily since the Trump administration backed out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which gave Tehran sanctions relief in exchange for a promise not to build nuclear weapons. Back in the United States, the House Judiciary Committee has subpoenaed former White House counsel Don McGahn to testify to Congress May 21st as part of an investigation into whether President Trump illegally sought to obstruct special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Mueller's report found McGahn defied President Trump's demand he fire Mueller, threatening to resign rather than carry out the order. McGahn later did resign. Meanwhile, President Trump and the Trump Organization have sued House Oversight Committee Chair Elijah Cummings in a bid to quash a subpoena demanding 10 years' worth of Trump's financial records. Cummings subpoenaed Trump's accountant to produce the documents after the president's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, testified that Trump routinely deflated his assets to reduce his taxes while inflating them in order to win bank loans. Meanwhile, House Democratic leaders warned rank-and-file lawmakers Monday against pressing for President Trump's impeachment. In a conference call with more than 170 lawmakers Monday evening, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other senior Democrats warned of the political consequences pressing for impeachment would have on the 2020 election. Pelosi said Democrats should instead focus on committee investigations into Trump. Over the weekend, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren became the first 2020 presidential candidate to call for Trump's impeachment. During town hall events hosted by CNN Monday night, candidates Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg said they don't support an immediate drive to impeach Trump, while California Senator Kamala Harris said she supports the idea.
I think we have very good reason to believe that there is an investigation that has been conducted, which has produced evidence that tells us that this president and his administration engaged in obstruction of justice. I believe Congress should take the steps towards impeachment.
Elizabeth Warren on Monday also unveiled a sweeping plan to cancel most student loan debt while making public colleges tuition free. Senator Warren's plan would cost $1.25 trillion to be funded by her proposed ultra-millionaire tax, an annual 2% tax hike on 75,000 U.S. households with $50 million or more in wealth. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders made free public college a cornerstone of both his 2016 and now 2020 campaigns, though Senator Warren says her idea goes further. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments today in a case challenging the Trump administration's plans to include a question on citizenship on the 2020 census. Justices will rule on whether Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had the authority to add the question to the census. The American Civil Liberties Union and 17 states have sued, saying Ross's move was aimed at deterring immigrants from participating in the census, leading to a vast undercount in states with large immigrant communities. This is journalist Ari Berman speaking on Democracy Now! Last Election Day.
The census is basically the DNA of our democracy. It determines so many things that we do, from how $675 billion in federal funding is distributed, to how political districts are drawn, to how many electoral votes states get. And if the census is rigged, then all of American democracy will be rigged as well.
The Supreme Court also said Monday it'll take up three cases that'll determine whether LGBTQ people will be covered by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which bars employers from discriminating against employees on the basis of sex, race, color, national origin, and religion. The Trump administration will argue the act was not intended to provide protection to gay or transgender workers. Justices will hear arguments in the case in the fall, with a decision likely by June of 2020. In the meantime, LGBTQ activists are calling on Congress to pass the Equality Act, which would amend civil rights laws to explicitly protect LGBTQ people against discrimination. Authorities at the University of Arizona in Tucson have dropped misdemeanor charges against three students who held a nonviolent protest against Border Patrol agents speaking on their campus. During the March 19th protest, the students called border agents Murder Patrol, an extension of the KKK. Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Tucson to speak with Mariel Bustamante, one of the so-called Arizona Three. In Washington, D.C., activists with the group Code Pink and Popular Resistance are occupying the Venezuelan embassy alongside a skeletal staff of Venezuelan diplomatic workers, where they're demanding the Trump administration cancel plans to turn the embassy over to Venezuelan opposition leaders. They're also protesting U.S. sanctions on Venezuela that have exacerbated a growing humanitarian crisis there. The U.S. State Department's ordered the group to vacate the building by Wednesday. In response, Code Pink's Medea Benjamin wrote, quote, "Like it or not, the Maduro government is actually the government in power in Venezuela and is recognized by the United Nations. This Trump-orchestrated plan of creating a parallel government and then simply taking over diplomatic premises is totally illegal," she said. President Trump said Monday one of his picks to join the Federal Reserve Board, Herman Cain, has withdrawn from consideration. Trump's nomination of Cain brought renewed scrutiny to the former Godfather's Pizza CEO and 2012 Republican presidential candidate, who withdrew from that year's race after three women accused him of sexual harassment. Meanwhile, another Trump nominee to the Federal Reserve Board, Stephen Moore, is under scrutiny after CNN uncovered sexist columns he wrote as a paid author at the National Review in the 2000s. One column, Moore argued women should be banned from the March Madness college basketball tournament, writing, quote, "Here's the rule change I propose. No more women refs, no women announcers, no women beer vendors, no women anything," unquote. Burma's Supreme Court has rejected the final appeal of a pair of Reuters reporters imprisoned for reporting on the systematic expulsion and murder of Rohingya Muslims from Burma in 2017. Just last week, reporters Walon and Joso U were honored with a Pulitzer Prize for their expose of a massacre of Rohingya committed by the Burmese military in the village of Indin. But on Monday, the pair were ordered to serve full seven-year prison terms for violating Burma's colonial-era Official Secrets Act. The United Nations, the U.S. House of Representatives, and international human rights and press freedom groups have all called for the journalists' release. In the Philippines, at least nine people were killed Monday after a strong 6.1 magnitude earthquake struck west of Manila during the evening rush hour. The earthquake collapsed buildings, including a four-story supermarket where five people were crushed to death by a falling wall. On Tuesday, a second, even more powerful quake struck the southern Philippines, north of the city of Tacloban. There were no immediate reports of injuries from the 6.4 magnitude quake. In climate news, a new study finds Greenland's ice sheet is melting at six times the rate it was in the 80s, in the latest sign that coastal cities around the world will face a catastrophic rise in sea levels. Monday's findings in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences show Greenland has lost 11 quadrillion pounds of water since 1972, with most of the melt coming in recent years. In London, the number of people arrested in a series of nonviolent direct actions urging radical action on climate change has topped 1,000 as the Extinction Rebellion enters its ninth day of protests in the British capital. On Monday, hundreds of Extinction Rebellion protesters staged a massive die-in in the main hall of London's Natural History Museum. And Polly Higgins, a British barrister who spent years campaigning for courts and governments to recognize ecocide as a major international crime, died Sunday of cancer. She was 50 years old. Polly Higgins drafted model laws defining the crime of ecocide and authored two books on the subject. In this video, produced by DSMOG UK and Real Media, she proposed making ecocide a crime on par with genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity.
We are legally advising on ecocide crime to become an international crime at the International Criminal Court. Ecocide is the extensive damage, destruction to, or loss of ecosystems. Existing law does not go far enough in terms of stopping serious harm, ecological harm and climatic harm. We're talking about criminal law here, so you're looking at CEOs, directors, ministers, heads of state who can be held to account within an international criminal court.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in New Mexico, where the FBI has arrested the head of an armed vigilante group that has repeatedly filmed itself detaining migrant border crossers at gunpoint. 69-year-old Larry Mitchell Hopkins is the leader of the far-right pro-Trump group calling itself United Constitutional Patriots, which the American Civil Liberties Union described as an armed and fascist militia organization. His arrest came just days after the ACLU accused the vigilantes of illegally detaining 300 migrants, including young children, near Sunland Park, New Mexico, last week. Videos posted on social media showed the vigilantes holding migrants at gunpoint. In one of the videos uploaded by the United Constitutional Patriots, a man is heard considering another means of dealing with the migrants.
The only problem is if we shoot on the Hill, it'll be an international crisis. We're too close to the border. Would save some time, though, wouldn't it?
The videos also show militia members praising President Trump's border policies and echoing Trump's rhetoric about a so-called invasion of migrants. New Mexico Attorney General Hector Baldadas praised the FBI for arresting Larry Mitchell Hopkins, the head of the vigilante group. Baldadas said, quote, "This is a dangerous felon who should not have weapons around children and families. Today's arrest by the FBI indicates clearly that the rule of law should be in the hands of trained law enforcement officials, not vigilantes," unquote. According to documents unsealed in court Monday, Hopkins was first brought to the attention of federal authorities in 2017 when the FBI received reports his group was training to assassinate Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and George Soros. His arrest Saturday on firearms charges comes 12 years after he was arrested in Oregon for unlawfully impersonating a police officer, and more than two decades after he was convicted for illegal possession of a loaded firearm in the state of Michigan in 1996. Joining us now is Peter Simonson, executive director of the ACLU of New Mexico. He's in Albuquerque. Welcome to Democracy Now, Peter. Can you lay out who this man is, who the FBI have just detained, and what his group was doing along the border?
Sure. Well, you've pretty much explained what we know about Mr. Hopkins to this point. You know, the group has been operating for a while now. I think since we found out about them late last fall, they had been convening down in the Sunland Park area, and we really did not expect to see any sort of activity of the kind that they have manifested over the last several weeks, where they are actually detaining people, dozens of families, at gunpoint, and, you know, threatening them. These are families that consist of young mothers, younger children, even infants. And, you know, if you watch the videos, they're just chilling. They're just heartrending to see innocent people exposed to this kind of a menace.
Now, Peter Simonson, there's quite a long history, isn't there, of vigilante groups along the border? I think back to the 1990s when there was a whole light up the border movement by people who were concerned then that there was a major crisis of migrants coming across the border, and there had been isolated instances. But now we're talking about it seems to be a regular, a more permanently organized group. Don't they actually have a small area that they're camping out in near the border?
Yes, that's true. The surge that we saw in the early 2000s in the name of the Minutemen really was kind of a temporary movement, it seemed, and they never demonstrated the kinds of behaviors that we're seeing right now. This group seems to have a permanent encampment there as of until Friday, this coming Friday. The El Paso Times, in fact, yesterday reported that the Union Pacific Railroad and the Sunland Park Police have required them to move off the premises, and they are putting up, as I understand it from this story, no trespassing signs in that area. So it's not entirely clear what the future fate of the vigilante group will actually be. But your point is exactly right. This is a more, appears to be a more determined group, and certainly a group that feels more empowered to take law into their own hands and doesn't seem to understand any of the consequences of their actions.
I'd like to turn to Jim Benvie, the spokesperson for the United Constitutional Patriots, who spoke to the El Paso Times.
People ask me also, what is the rule of engagement here? The rule of engagement is that we are here just like anybody else, and the only time that we're going to open fire is if we feel imminent threat or danger to our lives. We are a group of basically volunteer Americans who've come down here. We're retired vets, retired law enforcement, special forces. We've come down here not as a militia, but as a group of Americans to help protect the border crisis that's going on down here. This is a national security issue. Border Patrol is part of this as well. We're trying to assist them as far as in the overload. There's areas right now that the Border Patrol can't cover because we have too many people coming through the border claiming false asylum.
In one of the videos narrated by Jim Benvie, posted online, vigilantes armed with assault rifles are seen approaching a group of several dozen people seated on the ground.
Hey guys, this is Jim with the United Constitutional Patriots and We Build the Wall. As you can see, we did actually end up getting everybody wound up. It was a combination of us and some good horses over there, and basically a team effort here.
So, Peter Simonson, if you can describe the scene, some of these people, were they actually handcuffed? And talk about the distinction you make between a militia and vigilante.
Sure. I haven't seen that particular segment of the video, so I'm not privy to the particular details. There's 12 hours of video that they've posted on their Facebook site, and it's been hard to comb through all of it. We've actually been very appreciative of the media, like Democracy Now!, that has done some of that work for us. We think that these folks should be labeled vigilantes because they are taking the law into their own hands. They meet every definition of vigilante. They believe that they understand what the terms of justice should be better than what the law actually outlines for us, and are willing to actually go to the lengths of using heavy weaponry to enforce the law as they see it should be done. I think they only adopt the name militia for the purpose of trying to associate themselves with some sort of constitutional narrative that they think justifies their actions, when in fact they are just a lawless band of individuals who are misguided in their intentions.
And do you have any sense of what the Border Patrol relationship is to these groups? Does the Border Patrol discourage citizens from taking action, or does it welcome the support of some kind by locals?
Great question. I think this is one of the outstanding questions that we have right now. There's plenty of video evidence. I think you just showed some that suggests that the Border Patrol is actively collaborating with these folks, despite the fact that they've made a public statement saying that they neither condone nor endorse their activity. We have plenty of video documentation showing Border Patrol showing up to take the folks that they have illegally detained into custody. There are pictures of the Constitutional Patriots folks posing in photos with Border Patrol on horseback. There seems to have been a fairly easy and cooperative relationship between the vigilante group and the Border Patrol. And, you know, the question I am left with is, why did no one tell these folks to cease and desist? And if the Border Patrol is, in fact, a law enforcement agency, even if they themselves were not going to initiate an investigation into these folks, why couldn't they have called upon FBI to look into the matter? We met with the U.S. attorney here in New Mexico late yesterday afternoon, and asked him what has been done to tell these folks to stop what they're doing. And, you know, he could only share so much, but it's my understanding from, I have been given no evidence to say that any federal authority has told these folks they need to stop what they're doing. And so, you know, our key concern is that families' safety, there's families' welfare is at stake here. You look at those videos and what you see is literally dozens of families huddled in the sand in a remote part of the desert in the dead of night, surrounded by men in military camouflage, masked many times with heavy weaponry, semi-automatic weapons in some instances. You can only imagine a situation where somebody reaches for something in their pocket, pulls out a cell phone, and it looks like a firearm, and you have a gunfight that ensues. Those kinds of tragedies are the ones we've been really trying to move to avoid.
Speaking to BuzzFeed News, one of the vigilantes, Mark Cheney, acknowledged some members of the wore badges similar to those worn by Border Patrol agents. He said, if immigrants can't tell the difference, that's their problem. Now, isn't that Cheney's problem? I mean, you have the guy that the FBI just arrested 12 years ago being arrested in Oregon for unlawfully impersonating a police officer. Isn't it illegal to do that? And why is it just the head of this vigilante group that has been taken in? And if Trump is supporting them, what will happen next?
Amy, you're asking all the questions that are foremost in our mind right now. From all appearances, these folks were impersonating federal officers, even approaching immigrant families and announcing themselves as U.S. Border Patrol. In other cases, announcing themselves as policia to the Spanish-speaking immigrants. I don't understand how, under any definition that you see in federal law, they can't be charged. And by they, I mean not just Mr. Hopkins, but the rest of the folks there that are gathered on the border with falsely impersonating being a federal officer. And that's just the beginning of possible federal charges against these folks. We're also looking at possible kidnapping, conspiracy to kidnap. The fact that they have that they're armed and holding people at gunpoint only adds to the seriousness of those federal crimes. And so really, we are hoping to see that our federal authorities are going to bring further charges against these people, because the video evidence, and there's a wealth of it, shows that they appear to be guilty of multiple crimes. And Mr. Hopkins is just the tip of the iceberg.
And of course, we only know about this because they made a video. They themselves posted it online. How much is this happening along the border? And let's not forget that your state, New Mexico, is where the two children in Border Patrol custody died, the migrant children.
Yeah. Exactly. And beyond that, obviously, these folks lack some degree of competence that they were so bold as to actually broadcast, advertise, videotape their illegal activity. But you have to think at some point some caution must have clicked in, and where their more extreme actions were happening, maybe they didn't videotape. So I don't think we know the full story of how these people were actually treating the families that they were illegally taking into custody. And who's to say whether somebody might be out in the desert still, having been the victim of a gunshot, or someone that was roughed up and escaped to another part of the border. I mean, we have no idea what these people are doing to the families that are coming across. And unless this activity is stopped, again, it could end very tragically.
But we do know that people like No More Deaths, who put bottles of water in the desert so that people won't die of thirst, are being arrested. Peter Simonson, I want to thank you for being with us, executive director of the ACLU of New Mexico. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to cover two campus protests, a sit-in at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and a protest at the University of Arizona around immigration presence on campus. Stay with us. Singing a song by Colleen Cotao in Nogales, Mexico, at the U.S. border. You can go to democracynow.org to see the images of a 16-year-old Mexican boy, Jose Antonio, who was shot and killed in that spot by the border wall by a Border Patrol agent. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, authorities at the University of Arizona in Tucson have dropped charges against three students who held a nonviolent protest against Border Patrol agents speaking on their campus. During the March 19th protest, the students called border agents murder patrol and, quote, an extension of the KKK, unquote. One of the students filmed part of their encounter from outside the classroom where the agents were speaking.
This is supposed to be a safe space for students, but we have the murder patrol here. How about you talk about slashing water? How about you talk about taking the shoes off migrants, letting them walk through the desert barefoot? How about you talk about all the graves of unidentified folks?
All three students were charged with misdemeanors. On Friday, motions to dismiss the charges were granted after the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups led a campaign on behalf of the students. We go now to Tucson, Arizona, where we're joined by Mariel Bustamante, one of the so-called Arizona Three. She's a graduating senior who's double majoring in law and anthropology. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mariel. Explain what happened, why you were there.
Hi, good morning. So it started when the Criminal Justice Club invited the Border Patrol on campus to speak to the club about a number of things like recruitment and such. Me and my fellow protesters, we saw them on campus and we decided to speak out because we were unhappy with their presence there. So that was why we were there, because we saw them armed in uniform, and we thought that their presence there was unnecessary.
And nothing happened to you at that time, but then you were later visited by at your mother's house by agents looking for you. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so we did our demonstration. It lasted about 45 minutes. No names were taken, no IDs, and we kind of went about our lives for a while. And then about 10 days later, police came to my mom's house, where I don't live, and to another one of the students' home with a citation for our disruption of an educational institution. And we'd signed the charges later. They said that if I didn't show up to my mom's house, that I would be subjected to arrest.
And can you talk about the university's response?
Yeah, so that was pretty interesting. The president released a series of emails, the first one supporting student free speech on campus. He didn't really pick a side. He said, you know, students should be able to speak out. All sides are welcomed. And then a few days later, after meeting with the vice president of the Border Patrol Council, Arte Cueto, on March 25th, things kind of changed. The university took a stance with Border Patrol supporting the Criminal Justice Club, and that's when we knew that that charges would be filed against us. And then there was another series of emails where, as more community support was coming about on our side, on behalf of us, the university, you know, wanted to do a series of campus conversations, supported free speech again. You know, there was a lot of confusion, a lot of juggling of thoughts from the university, and to this day, you know, they haven't really standed with either side other than the Border Patrol.
And what was the response of the faculty at the university to the charges against you?
So the faculty, it was overwhelming support, mostly, specifically from the faculty of color. The faculty of color mobilized together at first for the first two people who were charged, and then the additional third. More people came together. And there was a lot of support. They used their own individual community networks. They, depending where they were in their faculty, used their power to kind of talk to other staff and professors. And they mobilized to make sure that we were safe, that we had the resources we needed to try to, you know, finish school up, to help us get legal assistance. They really mobilized. They did letter writing campaigns. They had sit-ins with the president. They had lots of conversations with people around the school and the community. So they were very supportive.
So you'll be graduating now without charges?
Yes. Mm-hmm. As of, I got the call on Sunday saying that charges were dropped. So I will be able to hopefully graduate by May 9th.
Well, Mariel Bustamante, we want to thank you for being with us. University of Arizona student charged with a misdemeanor for protesting Border Patrol appearance on campus. The charges have just been dropped, and she will be graduating from U of A. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to another student protest.
Yes, we turn now to a protest over immigration by students at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which has entered the 20th day. The students have been sitting in for 20 days in protesting the university's plans for an armed police force on campus, as well as Johns Hopkins' contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Hopkins students are demanding the cancellation of contracts with ICE and a pledge to donate all money received from ICE to Baltimore's Immigration Defense Fund. They're also demanding voluntary recognition for all workers wishing to unionize and a student and faculty representative spot on the university's Board of Trustees.
Democracy Now! Invited Johns Hopkins to join us on our show, but the university declined our request. We are going, though, to Baltimore, Maryland, where we're joined by two guests. Mariam Banahi is a Johns Hopkins graduate student participating in the sit-in. She's a PhD candidate in anthropology, writing a dissertation on asylum seekers in Germany. And Chris Bilal is a member of Students Against Private Police and also a member of the Washington Hill Community Association, who's participating in the Johns Hopkins sit-in. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mariam, let's begin with your protest around Johns Hopkins' relationship with ICE. What is it?
So we're very interested in how Hopkins presents itself as an ethical university and concerned with health and safety at home, but also its contracts with ICE. So since 2008, Hopkins has profited and made about $7 million from its contracts with ICE. Currently, there's about $1.7 million in contracts that are ongoing, and these are the administration puts these in terms that it's supportive of medical care and things like that, rather than actually supporting the detaining of asylum seekers. However, we see that as a kind of abstraction of the violence being enacted, but because they support the actual structures that make that facilitate the workings of ICE. So these contracts are set to expire this year. So we would like the university to end its contracts with ICE and donate the proceeds to something like the Immigrant Defense Fund.
Which is what?
It provides support for immigrants, asylum seekers and court cases, but also other kinds of immigrant justice efforts that can be decided upon later.
Now, another issue has been the university's attempt to begin to have an armed police force. Could you talk about that as well?
Yeah, I think Bilal can speak to that as well.
Legislation just passed. Thank you for having me. Very dangerous legislation has just passed in Baltimore, granting this university, which is a repeat offender in terms of crimes against Baltimore City residents, they now have a police power. And so, again, 75% of the students at Johns Hopkins University said they did not want the police force. A bunch of community associations, primarily across Baltimore City, also said that they did not want this force. There was a letter written by 100 faculty members of the administration who also said that, you know, they wanted to disarm, de-escalate, and kind of defund this machine that was going to happen, and really calling for other solutions and investment in things like mediation, Safe Streets, ROCA, and community-driven alternatives to policing, because as a public health institution, Johns Hopkins University knows better and knows that more policing does not equate with less crime, but that more policing actually causes gentrification. It causes more anxiety and public health concerns around communities. It causes the extraction of wealth from communities and also normalizes state-sanctioned violence and terror against black and brown bodies across America. So, yeah, a lot of the students are kind of challenging and demonstrating against this investment in the mass incarceration system and the school-to-prison pipeline, and are demanding equity in terms of Hopkins reinvesting that money after divesting into community-driven alternatives that actually support the sustainability and wellness of people in Baltimore City.
And, Mariam, I wanted to ask you about the sit-in and the how long it's lasted now, 20 days, and what the administration's response has been. But I wanted to first play a clip that earlier this month, some of your protesters confronted the university's president, Ron Daniels, and he peppered him with questions, and he refused to answer any of their questions. Let's go to a clip from that exchange.
Make sure we're safe. So, I mean, you just want me to.
So, as I said to you, I have no intention scheduling anything with you until you clear out of the building, and then you can get with any other student group that's always available to, which is schedule a meeting if you want to talk about things you're concerned.
Yeah, so we've been trying to discuss the private police for over a year.
That was the president being confronted by one of the students, one of your fellow protesters. Mariam, what has been the response of the university to this long sit-in now?
Yes, so we're actually going into, today is day 21 of the sit-in. So it's been going for 3 weeks now. We'll continue it, and we'll continue to escalate. The university response has actually been quite disappointing. We actually have, it's basically non-response. As you saw, President Daniels, the provost, Provost Kumar, refuses to speak with us. And they also, since the beginning, have refused to offer us anything in writing from our conversations and the like. The only responses that we receive for them are coordinated drop-offs of basically threats, written statements. Any time that there is a supposed violation that they deem is a violation. So I think they're creating a paper trail in order to pursue disciplinary actions against students as soon as this is over, as soon as it's over for them. But so it's quite alarming that there are these methods being used to intimidate protesters, intimidate students, as well as we've heard reports that the dean's office has been calling faculty members, especially faculty members who are in more precarious positions, and threatening them to discourage them from supporting the sit-in. From anyone who's stepping in the space is also being pursued and surveilled in these ways, which is extremely alarming and which actually gives credibility to our concerns about what Hopkins would do with its own private armed police force on campus and beyond and in the community. Another thing to mention is that the faculty supports the sit-in. There's a unanimous faculty assembly resolutions. So the community is also supportive of the sit-in, and the support is growing. Surely it's growing, and we had a great number of supporters coming in this weekend. We have a whole slew of events this week and into the weekend that are already being advertised. Pastor Heber Brown III of Pope Pleasant Hope Baptist Church has expressed his support and came and visited us on Sunday with members of his congregation, and we'll do that again next Sunday at 4 p.m., so all are welcome.
I wanted to add to that is that I was one of the people who was asking the questions to President Daniels. And as a community member, I think that the administration's posture of silence towards communities is really bad. And I know folks who were involved in kind of like similar movements in the past will understand when ACT UP said that silence equals death. So a lot, what was interesting is his answers to a lot of questions. The police force's build is something that will generate safety for the people and residents of Baltimore and the students of Johns Hopkins University. But the more that I speak to students, especially women on campus, there's a big trend of women saying that they'll feel safe when sexual assault is investigated on campus. That safety looks like investigating frat houses that have committed sexual crimes against folks on campus. I've also learned that one out of three undergrads also face sexual assault. And there was this weird case at Hopkins where 18 cases of sexual assault were like kind of deleted and kind of like this weird computer glitch. So when people talk about safety, that's actually a lie because Hopkins has been unable to protect its own students and make its own students feel safe. So there's no way that they're going to be able to make people like me safe without profiling me. It was also really scary. I asked President Daniels about mediation because basically Hopkins has a long history of experimenting on black and brown people in Baltimore. It has a huge history of not paying taxes in Baltimore. John Hopkins as a person was actually a liquor distributor who like poisoned people, and also his family like owned tobacco farms. And so they have a long history of poisoning the people of Baltimore and also not like listening to people of Baltimore. So this is a situation where students were demanding a mediation, you know, so, like the faculty senate kind of proposed a neutral, non-Hopkins affiliated, mutually agreed upon mediator in which the folks could talk to administration officials like Dean Smita and Kevin and Ron Daniels, who have sat in spaces and have heard these students talk about their concerns about safety, talk about their concerns about the accountability Accountability Board, talked about their concerns around the boundaries, talked about how they want President Ron Daniels to resign. And if Ron Daniels doesn't want to resign, I believe that he should mediate with students or negotiate with students. Or again, there was a part in the video when he said, are you going to come to dinner? And I think we would like to come to dinner. I think that we would actually like to see Ron Daniels come to the sit-in and have dinner with students and community members and the coalition of interfaith folks who are interested in this to come through. Or we can have dinner at President Daniels' house, because the last time that he invited the BSU, the Black Student Union, to his house around concerns around this, he actually kicked them out and said that they are ungrateful. So we're also demanding that he speak with the BSU, that he speak with people from the Black and Brown communities who have not been consulted, and that they also continue those meetings that they were having, these public meetings around the police force. They canceled those meetings and refused to talk to people.
We only have a few more minutes, but I wanted to ask you, one of the demands of the sit-in is justice for Tyrone West. And I want to turn to West's sister, Tawanda Jones, speaking to WMAR 2 News.
To know that this can happen, these are not isolated incidents by far. It's systemically happening. It's happening all over the world. Accountability looks like those officers involved in my brother's brutal execution held accountable.
For those who don't know, who was Tyrone West?
Tyrone West was a Baltimorean who was the sister of Tawanda. The brother of Tawanda. And he was actually murdered by police officers from Morgan State University, another university in Baltimore City, which has a police force that Hopkins is modeling their police force off of. And so Sister West has been out here next week will be her 300th week outside demanding justice for Tyrone West. You know, the state actually didn't release a lot of information in the case. There are a lot of discrepancies in the coroner's report. There are two different autopsies. One that kind of basically says that he was murdered in a case of state sanctioned terror against him. And then, of course, the state's narrative, which says that, you know, he killed himself, which happens all too often. So Tawanda West has been out there every Wednesday for 299 weeks demanding justice and accountability for her brother. And, you know, this is really sad because we were just, you know, watching the news from Yale, how a police officer from Yale also just shot Stephanie and Paul. So we're asking for justice for Tyrone West and justice for Stephanie and Paul. And we also agree with their demands to disarm the YPD department and disarm John Hopkins University.
And this also ties back to the case at Barnard recently with Alexander McNabb being stopped by campus police coming in. He was a Columbia student going onto Barnard's campus, which is normal business as usual. I'm a Barnard alumna, so I was extremely disturbed by seeing this. And he was accosted and pinned to the counter once he entered the library. And this has been repetitive. However, President Bylock of Barnard has had a much better response to what has happened than President Daniels has at Hopkins. She's been calling for changes. She recognizes the pernicious racialized atmosphere and the racial profiling that takes place on campuses. I think Ron Daniels needs to take a look at this.
Mariam Banahi, we want to thank you for being with us, Johns Hopkins graduate student in anthropology, and Chris Bilal, member of Students Against Private Police and also a member of the Washington Hill Community Association, both participating in the sit-in now in its 21st day at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. When we come back in 30 seconds, we continue on what's happening in Baltimore and around this country. We'll be speaking with Dee Watkins, author of We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. Stay with us. It's one wicked road, you're gonna make it right. You found your way to go, you're gonna take that ride. No matter where you belong, no matter where you ride. You gotta wait too long, no matter where you ride. Generationals. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to another voice from Baltimore. Dee Watkins, editor-at-large for Salon and best-selling author of the new book We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. In his book, Watkins amplifies the experiences of poor black Americans, he says, are typically sidelined by the public and the media, including his own life story. He writes, quote, "I'm from the bottom. And what I mean by bottom is first-generation scholars, the project babies, the people without Wi-Fi, the workers, the people most likely to get hit by police bullets. We are the subjects of protests, the rarely heard from, even as our deaths are debated by media personalities who wouldn't step foot in our blocks." To quote the brilliant scholar and activist Dr. Suad Abdul Habir, "You don't need to be a voice for the voiceless. Just pass the mic."
Dee Watkins joins us now in our New York studio, professor at the University of Baltimore, founder of the Be More Writers Project, also the author of The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir, and The B-Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Dee.
Thank you guys for having me.
And congratulations on the book. Talk about your own life story.
So I grew up in a place where, and it's crazy because, you know, and again, I don't step out there and try to be the voice for everybody. I can only speak for myself. But a lot of people from our community, we don't have, like, big connections to huge groups of activists, right? This is like a brand new culture for us. We don't have, you know, the media personalities who get the opportunity to debate and talk about our stories a lot. So, you know, when these things happen, these viral killings and these viral murders, and we see these names danced and tossed around the screen, a lot of people who actually are the victims, they don't, you know, they don't get a chance to interact with these types of people before it happens. And then we get, like, brand new hashtags. So this has been, like, the basis of not just my story, but the story of, like, a whole lot of people. So I try my best to use my platform to elevate other people so that we can build, like, a bigger narrative for what the contemporary black experience is.
And you were listening to this previous segment that we had on the student protests at Baltimore, at Johns Hopkins. Of course, Johns Hopkins is this elite school in the middle of a majority black city.
I went to school there, and I taught there. It's not fun. It's not, you know, you feel like when you are a black person, well, my experience there has been like, you know, I kind of felt like an alien. So when I heard the message about Ron Daniels kicking the BSU out of his house, it wasn't like a strange thing for me. Baltimore was a 65% black city. You can probably count the tenured professors of color on like one hand, you know. So what those students are going through and what they're fighting is it's a real thing. And, you know, giving them a police force could potentially lead to the murder of an innocent person. Like, it's not even, you know, it sounds so sad and horrible for me to say it, but it's a reality. It's something that could definitely happen.
You have a chapter in your book, "I'm Sick of Woke." What do you mean?
Sick of woke culture. It's like everybody's running around, you know, and it's crazy because it started from a great place. It's a great place when you're calling out people and when you're challenging systems and when you're trying to make it better for everybody. It's great. But when it gets to the point where, like, you know, you're using terminology like microaggression and intersectionality and all of these different things to demonize people who don't even know what you're talking about, it creates like these hierarchies within movements and these hierarchies within different classes of people. And it just it gets ridiculous. You know, it's becoming like, you know, like fake thugs. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to have this bravado and in this sea of words and language that everyone has to adhere to, when it's just, it becomes even more divisive and it fights against what it's actually supposed to mean.
I want to ask you about, you have a chapter in your book on the tradition of failure and education, and you say near the beginning, "The lack of progress made in public schools over the last 50 years is embarrassing, and anyone who has the power to fix this but chooses not to truly wants poor black kids to fail." And you go on the history of education in relationship to African American and the system of failure.
Yeah, it's like what name one subject you hated in school when you were growing up.
I would say math.
Okay, so imagine doing it in like freezing cold. You know what I'm saying? And this isn't the freezing cold in 1965. This is 2017, 2018, and 2019, where there's videos of students at Baltimore City Public Schools, you know, trying to take notes, but they got to stop the blowing their hands while they got coats and scarves and earmuffs on because the inside of their school is freezing. And, you know, the governor, Larry Hogan, didn't make a statement or say anything about it until the video started going viral. So it's never like, you know, these issues exist. You've been new. Everybody knows. We've been talking about it for a long time. If my older brother and cousins and friends and all of the people who went to schools always talked about the resources that they didn't have and how messed up it was. And then my dad and his generations of people that he came up with always talk about back to schools were. And then I have the same thing. And then my nephews and their little friends are saying the same thing. It's like, at what point do we fix this? You know, it's like, I guess it's 2019.
Let me go to President Obama talking about race and policing at a 2016 town hall that was hosted by ABC News.
There is real concern about making sure that interactions between police and community don't result in death. And nobody wishes that more than police officers themselves. Because when you talk to those police officers who have, whether justified or not, whatever the findings, have ended up killing somebody, it shatters them too. I don't know anybody in the African American community or Latino community or others that may have concerns about policing that don't also recognize we need police.
So that was Barack Obama when he was president at a town hall. You were there, Dee Watkins. Can you respond to what he said and what President Obama meant to you and then President Trump?
You know, so that was like a special day for me because Obama was like my big entry into, like, I literally write and study and read politics all day, every week for me. So I'm really into it. And that came with from following his election. So the minute I get an email telling me, I actually get to go sit in the room with this guy who's meant so much to me, was like amazing. And then when I'm sitting there and I'm hearing him talking about how, you know, we can't really prosecute police officers because we need them to protect us, I'm like, man, they're blowing our heads off. And it was a difficult thing. So, you know, part of me was like, well, okay, so he's going to say what he has to say because this is around the time Trump was starting to catch steam. This is when the MAGA rally started popping up and he started to get popular. But at the same time, we were in a room full of victims. One of them was Erica Gardner, and she was promised a chance, you know, to be able to tell her story and talk about her experience and how the man who killed her father is actually got a raise from overtime with his new desk job after that happened. So
That was Eric Garner.
Eric Garner. So it started off as being like a great experience, but it ended up being a rough day because that's, you know, it's the conversation was kind of like the president and the people and the people. And Erica was definitely the people because like Tawanda, she was out there all of the time, like trying to get justice for her dad. And she had this opportunity, and which really wasn't an opportunity. So they brought her down there from
nothing. But she never got to speak at that time, well, did she?
She got to speak, but she didn't get to speak. Like nobody, only people who knew were people who were there, and that's because she exploded and stormed off the set. So when she left the set, Secret Service was like, "Oh, where you going, Ned?" And she was like, "Yo, don't touch me. This is horrible." And someone from Obama's team had reached out and was like, "Okay, well, you're gonna get to talk to him for like 2 seconds." And she told me and some other people who we were all going back to the train station because they were going to New York and we were going back to Baltimore, and she was like, yo, he basically said that he can't really speak on what's happening because this Dallas police situation is helping Trump out. And she's like, I don't care about that. Like, why does everything have to be about politics? I care about this person who killed my father going to jail, and it looks like it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And so your assessment of Trump today and what he's meant for the African-American community?
Absolutely nothing. Like, Donald Trump is a scum. Like he is everything that, you know, everything we feel when we have an encounter with a racist police officer, everything we feel when we know we're qualified for a job or a loan that we don't get, everything that tears us apart as we try to navigate in this country. And again, you know, I'm not the guy who's trying to say everyone feels like this, but I can say everything that I felt and the struggles I've had in academia and in media and in general have, you know, is all represented in him. It's all wrapped up in this bloated orange face. face. Like every all that anger and that aggression is right there. You know, he's a clear example of it. And he can laugh and he can joke and he can, you know, fraud the world. And it's disheartening to sit back and watch how many people are content with that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dee Watkins, editor-at-large for Salon. His new book, We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. Dee Watkins is a professor at the University of Baltimore, founder of the Be More Writers Project. That does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking Saturday night at 6 o'clock. We'll be doing a showing of 4 days in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony, at University of California, Berkeley. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Has an immediate opening for a full-time digital fellowship here in New York City. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.